I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, how could the North Korean situation spiral out of control? Our guest for the first half of this hour gives us some scenarios. The North Koreans mistakenly believe the U.S. is going to launch an attack on them, and Kim Jong-un does something crazy. The North Koreans stage yet another provocation. This time, South Korea responds. The Trump administration talks itself into a conflict it cannot contain. North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons finally spawns on an arms race with Japan. The North Korean regime collapses internally, creating a failed state. We're going to be spending the first part of the show this hour examining all those possibilities. Later, what role does China play in helping avoid a full-blown war? Is there any possibility of successful negotiation, despite our having a long history of failed negotiations? What would North Korea want? What does the U.S. want? What does China want? We'll have two guests with us on this very important topic that's on all of our minds these days. We start with David Schmirmer. David Schmirmer is a research associate at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, studies the missile and nuclear programs of North Korea and Iran, as well as issues of East Asian security. Later in the hour, a senior fellow in the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative in the Center for 21st Century Security at Brookings Institution of Washington. This guest served as U.S. Department of State Special Advisor for Nonproliferation and Arms Control. All hour. I know many of you have concerns about what's going on and questions. We welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And David, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. How worried are you, David, that the North Korean situation could spiral out of control?
It's not something that is causing me to stay up late at night, with the exception of all the crazy new propaganda videos and pictures that the North Koreans are releasing. But it's something that we should take seriously. We have a state that issues threats because it feels very insecure about its own existence, and we have a presidency with a president who issues ultimatums on Twitter, declaring that North Korea won't test an ICBM. And, those things are taken very seriously. So if they do, does the president feel compelled to, try to stand behind his tweets, or does he act more aggressive? And how aggressive can we get on the Korean Peninsula before things get out of control?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something where I think it's imminent, but I think that it's a bit worrying. It could very easily spin out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I think we're not in the best place, but it's not the end of the world yet.
When President Obama warned Donald Trump before he became president that North Korea is the most significant issue you'll face, do you think he was correct?
North Korea is the path North Korea is pursuing is something that we don't accept, and it's something that would be very hard for the United States and the rest of the world to accept. So, but they're going to keep charging on this path regardless. There are a couple issues that they would want addressed before they would even consider changing course, and that takes into consideration the ability to even work with North Koreans on some type of diplomatic issue. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think North Korea is a very big issue. So,
in the New York Times today, there were a couple lengthy articles about North Korea. The Leader has this article said enough fissile material for 20 to 25 nuclear weapons may be able to produce sufficient materials, plutonium and highly enriched uranium, for 6 to 7 new weapons a year. Should they conduct a 6th nuclear test, they would move closer to having a hydrogen bomb with 1,000 times more power than the Hiroshima-style weapons that he has detonated so far. I mean, that's a pretty alarming sentence.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, definitely. I mean, North Korea has a developing nuclear program, and they want bigger and better bombs so that they can threaten the United States with it. The entire program exists to keep the Americans out and to prevent us from intervening and potentially removing Kim the same way we did with Gaddafi and Saddam.
Mm-hmm. So,
you want reasoning for them to develop a nuclear weapons program, or starting to test ICBMs, which they haven't done yet, but they're moving towards. It's they've seen what happens to states that oppose the United States, and they didn't have nuclear weapons programs. In fact, I think Gaddafi was planning on building one, and he negotiated with the United States out of that. Had he had a nuclear weapons program, maybe Gaddafi would still be there, and this is something that's always hanging over the leadership's head, I think.
David, tell me what you know about these. I just heard, and I haven't read much about this, that the missile that failed over the weekend, there were reports that there was cyber warfare conducted, perhaps that's why it failed, and then I read somewhere that the Obama administration had done a lot of work in this area. How do you stop a missile from failing doing it through cyber warfare?
So this is a great question. I mean, cyber is a bit out of my area of expertise, but understanding to a basic level North Korea's ballistic missile program, it's kind of hard for me to imagine that they just, like, hacked into a missile. If the missile identification is correct, the one that failed over the weekend, mirroring the one that failed on the 5th of this month, launched from the general same area, is based on more, and I say primitive, and I don't mean to diminish the dangerous capabilities of this missile, but something closer to a Scud, which was North Korea's first larger ballistic missile that they got from Egypt in 1979, 1980, and they've done modifications to it to make them better, but I don't think there's like a digital interface to hack into it. But one of the things that they could do, and I say this, I'm wondering if we should even talk about it, because if this is actually how it's working, I really don't want to give the North Koreans any hints on where to check. But they use CNC machines to produce a lot of parts for their missiles. And one of the things that you could do, possibly, is try to inject some type of program into the machining tools used to make their missiles. And if you start changing small numbers and measurement capabilities, you could degrade the quality of the material that they're making the missiles out of. And because missiles go under intense amounts of stress in a very short period of time, it's like a metal tube that flies in the air with fire on one end, right? Shaving off a couple millimeters or even less than that on, like, let's say the fuel tank of a missile could compromise its structural integrity, and once it launches, it could blow up. So if they were using cyber means to hamper North Korea's ability to produce missiles, that's one way you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want you to respond to, we have a couple of sound clips here. This is from Mike Pence, who was at the DMZ early Monday morning, and then a little later the response from the North Korean ambassador to the UN. I'd like to play what they had to say and hear what you have to say about their comments. Here's Mike Pence at the DMZ.
Since 1992, the United States and our allies have stood together for a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. We hope to achieve this objective through peaceful means, but all options are on the table. Just in the past 2 weeks, the world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president in actions taken in Syria and Afghanistan. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve or the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region. We will continue to deploy the THAAD missile defense system as a defensive measure called for by the alliance and for the alliance. We will continue to evolve a comprehensive set of capabilities to ensure the security of South Korea. And as our Secretary of Defense made clear here in South Korea not long ago, we will defeat any attack and we will meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective response.
All options on the table. He mentioned Afghanistan and Syria. Was he threatening a military strike? And then obviously the next question is, what in the world would happen if there were a military strike conducted by the U.S. on North Korea?
Well, I think when you're dealing with this, and this is something that the Trump administration has kind of stressed even before Donald Trump was elected, was this unpredictability. I'm unpredictable, so you can't, use traditional thought processes to try to work a way around getting one over President Trump. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But a strike in any fashion on the Korean Peninsula would be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea is very nervous about that. They're very aware of America's military superiority over them. And from missile tests that we've seen in the past, some propaganda maps. I mean, North Korea's plan for this is the minute they feel like their security is going to be compromised, they're just going to launch everything they have and try to inflict as much damage from the start.
So it would be horrendously damaging to that whole peninsula, to China, to Japan, to South Korea?
The military bases in Japan would be targeted. South Korea, Seoul would all suffer horrible losses. It wouldn't be good. North Korea isn't like Syria. You can't strike them and then Syria will soak up that blow and carry on, petition internationally. I mean, North Korea doesn't really have that option. So once you compromise what they believe is their security, then, that raises into question the survival of the regime. And if you start questioning that, or they feel like the regime is threatened in an imminent fashion, then they're going to launch.
The Vice President Pence mentioned since 1992, so you've had the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, nobody able to really figure this out. Why is it so hard?
So hard to work with the Korean Peninsula problem?
Yes.
This is the way the peninsula works. Even before they started developing testing nuclear weapons, Seoul is only, 40 kilometers away from the DMZ, which puts it in range for massive artillery strikes. The options for some type of solution on the Korean Peninsula just doesn't... It's hard to make comparisons or examples for anything. The Korean Peninsula is its own thing. Maybe, hopefully not, but later on in time, we will run into situations that you would compare to Korea. But Korea is just... it's its own special, unique problem, and it's hard to say why there isn't an easy option. It's just, it is what it is, and it's something that we have to kind of accept. Hmm. Hard to draw parallels between that and other situations.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also wondering, how is it that the leader has been able to spend what must be enormous sums of money to build all of these missiles when they went through a horrendous famine not that many years ago, and people aren't doing, I'm sure, very well, nowhere near as well economically secure as people in South Korea? How can you spend all your money on the military and sacrifice the well-being of your people?
Well, I think... obviously, that is a horrible decision to make. The situation in North Korea is not good by any means whatsoever, and there are tons of issues. And it's a tragedy, the situation, society that they have to live in. But it comes down to, do you have happy citizens or do you lose the state? I think that's the question, or how they have it framed. You could have a prosperous society at the expense of a potential loss of the existence of the state, or you can, triage the former and put more money into the defense of the state to ensure the regime's survival. And the regime's survival is paramount to nothing else. So.
Mm. I said that I would play the North Korean ambassador's response to Vice President Pence's comments and to the whole situation. Here was what he said at the United Nations.
The United States is disturbing and the global peace and the stability and insisting on the gangster-like logic. The United States introducing in South Korea, the Korean Peninsula, the world's biggest hotspot, the huge nuclear strategic asset, seriously threatening the peace and security of the peninsula and pushing the situation there to brink of war. It has been created a dangerous situation in which the thermonuclear war may break out at any moment.
Oh, and you would think it would have been never again. The thought, even the words that people are saying a nuclear war could break out, send shivers, doesn't it?
It's not a happy thought.
No.
So the North Koreans will do this often. It's part of their...
Mm-hmm.
Their message that they want to convey, because I don't think, even though they convey this idea that they're always ready, I don't think the North Koreans are necessarily interested in having an armed conflict, but they need to portray this sense of strength and aggressive military posture, because they believe that is what keeps the enemies for them at bay. So North Korea will often criticize or call it the United States for making the region unsafe, or that we're always on the brink of war, and that's kind of part of the jargon that they used often. But again, I mean, this time it looks maybe a little bit different because we have a new president, and his first big military, action, if you would, looked kind of intimidating to the North Koreans. So I would take that kind of seriously.
Let's take some phone calls. Our guest the first half hour, we're talking about North Korea and the U.S., and, of course, I have to throw in China and Japan and South Korea. We'll talk more about South Korea, what their response has been. David Schmerler is our guest. He's a research associate at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, studies the missile and nuclear programs of North Korea and Iran, as well as issues of East Asian security. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we start with Mike in St. Lawrence. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen, and your guest. I called in a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about something else, and I mentioned Korea, and I was pretty sure I didn't know what the answer was at the time, but apparently we have never signed a formal ceasefire or end the war. We sent an armistice, but we never had a peace treaty with North Korea. So my comment is, why don't we do that? I mean, what's the problem? We're not going to go to war with North Korea. Let's pull back half of our 28,000 troops along the DMZ. I think it's time to end this fiasco. I think if we made and get our armada out of there, perhaps in South North Korea would say, oh, wow, and China would have nothing to say then whatsoever. They'd have to say, hey, look, Kim Il-soo or whatever his name is, Americans are making one heck of an effort here. Let's get something going. I mean, this is insane. I mean, they think that we're going to invade them. They think we're going to bomb them. They're still at war with us. Maybe he's a little wacko and he's only 22 years old or 24, whatever he is now, but still, I mean, let's take an initiative here and let's end this thing.
Mike, thanks for the call. David.
Yeah, well, that's drifting a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I can offer some insights. We haven't signed a peace treaty yet, and I think one of the problems is that neither state want to acknowledge the existence of the other one on the Korean Peninsula. Like, they know it's there, but officially the acceptance of that country, I think, isn't a question. Also, I mean, yeah, North Korea is a very threatening state. They have a lot of very threatening weapons, and they use threatening language constantly to talk about turning the capital of South Korea into a sea of fire. So when, let's say hypothetically, the U.S. starts to pull out of South Korea, how does South Korea feel? How does Japan feel? Do they feel threatened still? And if so, do they arm? And if they start to increase their military spending and development, North Korea is going to see that not as a way to reach parity with each other, but as a threat to them, again, because North Korea is constantly under this state of preparation for war. So then they accelerate their weapons program, and what you have is a regional arms race. And that is maybe more destabilizing than the current situation. I know that sounds kind of weird, but it's one of the possibilities that could happen. So. Mm.
Mike mentioned, David, the existence of 28,000 troops along the DMZ. Do we have that many there?
I can't give you a number right off the top of my head, but I do know we have a lot of troop stations in South Korea.
Mm. Yeah. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Bob in Middleton is next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. A lot of the thunder of my question has already been answered by the last discussion. However, one thing I have noticed is distinctly missing from the dialogue on all media sources is the question of where's the South Korean voice within all this? Obviously, they're having a lot of issues with their president being impeached and domestic issues, but truly they are ground zero for whatever the outcome might be.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Yeah. Where is the South Korean voice on this? That's an interesting question. We're having a election coming up, and that new voice may shift. We've had different policies towards North Korea from South Korea, most of them being a bit more conservative along the lines of what our Republican Party would have here. However, there is an instance of a sunshine policy towards North Korea where South Korean presidency tried to offer the olive branch, if you would. And we have no idea what the next president of South Korea's approach is going to take, whether it's going to be more hawkish or more of a dove. I think the reason why we're not really hearing much of a voice in the way that we would traditionally hear in the past is because, you know, we have a new administration coming in, so it's a bit hard to predict which stance South Korea will take.
What's the stance of their military? Do they have a lot of military?
Yeah, the South Koreans, yeah, they have a great military. They have a fully developed, functioning military, yeah.
And what about Japan? You would imagine that all of this would make people in Japan and the government very nervous. There have to be talks about what they're going to do, how they're going to build up their military, aren't there?
Yeah. So Japan is in kind of an awkward. It's in a rough position because there's still a lot of legacy of Japan's actions from World War II lingering in East Asia. And if Japan were to arm because they felt that the American military assurance in the region was compromised, they would have to take that into consideration to how, I mean, obviously North Korea not liking more armed Japan, but even China, how they would view that. Because that is an issue that is brought up every now and then about how Japan should not rearm because the legacy of their actions during World War II have still carried over.
Right. So. Thank you, Bob, for your call. We go to Rod in La Crosse. Hi, Rod.
Yes, I'm old enough to remember, live through the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the things that I learned years later, the reason Khrushchev had Russian missiles placed in Cuba, nuclear warheads, we, the United States, had placed nuclear weapons, missiles in Turkey on Russia's doorstep prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they got out of the crisis, Kennedy agreed to, remove those nuclear missiles from Turkey. And, of course, then Khrushchev complied. But I think we're a bit hypocritical to go around saying, oh, how awful, these people want a nuclear arsenal, when we're the ones who created nuclear weapons and we're the only country that actually used them in war. I mean, we're the first to create the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb. Maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I think we need to look at ourselves a little bit, too.
But what do we do? I mean, considering the actions of the leadership of North Korea, it's a pretty scary place. What do we do with their being very close to a missile that could hit the United States? You have to factor that in, Rod, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying I think the Cuban Missile Crisis may have been more serious than what we're facing. North Korea hasn't got a missile that'll span the Pacific Ocean. But in 1962, Russian missile,
it was close.
Could have easily hit all of our major cities.
Yeah, it was. We were pretty close to a nuclear war at that point. And yesterday, some analyst who knows the area said what he is seeing is a Cuban missile crisis in slow motion. Would you agree with that assessment, David?
I wasn't around for the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm a bit young. But from what I've read and other people who were around that did live through it, and even looking at the documents that talk about things that happened that we didn't know about during the time, I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis was terrifying. That mm-hmm. was something that was immediate, and it was right there, and it could have happened any second. The North Koreans are still testing. They're working on beginning to test their ICBM technology. They haven't had a test of an ICBM that we know of yet, and that may be because they've tested one, it blew up, and we didn't hear about it, or just because they haven't yet. So their ability at the present to hit the United States is a little bit far off, but it's still concerning because it is the direction that they are fully dedicated towards moving in. With that said, I mean, again, the United States is tied closely to South Korea and Japan, so just because they don't have the ability to hit the United States doesn't mean that a more regional conflict with missiles, with potentially, potentially nuclear-armed missiles in the region is any less terrifying. I mean, Seoul, larger cities in Japan, these are a lot of people that we're talking
about. Right, yeah.
So it's, a lot of people put the focus on whether or not they can hit the United States, and that's a huge concern that we should have. But I've been to Seoul. I lived there for a little bit, and I love that city. It's a beautiful place with great people, and we're kind of removed from thinking about that, but those areas are certainly in danger.
Right. Yeah. One final comment or question to you from someone on Facebook. Tim writes, so the North Koreans believe with all their heart that if they don't get nukes, the West will topple their government. Everything that I've heard, Tim says that our saber rattling is counterproductive. And he would like for you, David, to play this thought experiment. What would happen if we promised them we won't invade, we won't topple their government, we'll just leave them alone? We could even offer them food and trinkets. What would happen?
Well, you'd have to take into consideration that we, you know, have offered things like this to other states in the past. I know that we were, you know, kind of at odds with Gaddafi in Libya when we came to a certain form of agreement where, you know, Gaddafi was allowed to remain there. And as soon as, you know, things went south for Gaddafi, the United States was, you know, fully or partially invested in having him removed. So I think we're beyond the point where the North Koreans are going to believe that if we say we promise we're not going to invade you, that they're going to take that sincerely on any level.
David, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me on.
David Schmerler, research associate at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, and he's been studying nuclear programs of North Korea and Iran and issues of East Asian security. We continue. We're talking about North Korea this hour of the program. How likely is it that something really bad could be happening with North Korea, with the United States, and with all the other countries involved? Are we on the brink of war? Joining us in just a moment, a senior fellow in the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative from the Brookings Institution in Washington. We'll meet him momentarily here on the Ideas Network. And Robert Einhorn joins us now from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., senior fellow in the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. He has an interesting background. He knows this issue well. He served in the U.S. Department of State as Special Advisor for Nonproliferation and Arms Control, a position created by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2009. He also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs and a member of the State Department Policy Planning staff. He served at many other agencies as well. We are continuing our phone calls. Just stay on the line if we haven't been to you yet. We will soon. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join this conversation. Robert, hello, and thank you very much for being with us. Hello. Oh, wait a second. You're in a different line here.
Darn.
Hi, Robert. Oh, there you are, clear as can be. Thank you for being with us.
Sure.
Yeah. One area that we have not yet discussed, and I'd like to begin with you on China. Evidently, the talks, negotiations with North Korea, if possible, and we've been through them before, would be the preference of China. Are those possible? Does China have influence to get talks started? And we don't have a long history of great, successful negotiations.
We sure don't. China does have a lot of leverage on North Korea. About 85 or 90% of North Korea's trade goes through China. China supplies much of North Korea's food, much of its fuel oil, so it has leverage. But until now, China has not been prepared to use that leverage in a decisive way. China is concerned that if it put too much pressure on the regime in Pyongyang, that it might collapse. And that would be a catastrophe for China because this would involve, you know, tens of thousands of North Korean refugees streaming into China. But more important than that, it could involve the collapse of the regime and the end of the buffer state that China has relied upon. So China is prepared to put leverage on North Korea, but not really enough leverage to threaten the regime.
Mm. And what about the U.S.? Would we love to see the regime collapse?
Sure. It's a reprehensible regime. We'd love to see it collapse. The problem is that we don't really know how to go about it. This regime seems to have consolidated its power. Kim Jong-un, in a ruthless way, has consolidated its power. We see no signs that he is under any pressure internally. So I think even though we would hope to see this regime go away, and that's been our hope for decades, we think it's been pretty resilient. The Chinese are terribly concerned that we, if we put too much pressure, it will simply collapse and lead to great instability throughout Northeast Asia.
Mm. They must be very worried, though, about instability now and the possibility of a war, aren't they?
I think that is what's motivating the Chinese to take a tougher position toward the North. The China really doesn't want a war on the peninsula. And it's concerned about North Korea's actions, its missile tests, its nuclear program. It's concerned that the Trump administration may be prepared to use military force. And so China is doing everything possible to try to lower the temperature, calm things down. And I think really for the first time, more than ever before, the Chinese are prepared to put pressure on the North to get them to stand down from their programs. How much pressure? We'll see. But Xi Jinping, the president of China, met recently in Florida with President Trump. And apparently President Trump expects the Chinese to cooperate more effectively, to put more effective pressure on North Korea to get it at least to curtail and perhaps give up its nuclear and missile programs.
After the parade last week in North Korea, it's hard for me to believe that this regime has any intention at all of giving up their program. I mean, look at the display we saw. They're enormously proud of it, right? What else do they have to show off?
You're absolutely right. They're proud of it. They believe that their nuclear and missile programs are the key to their survival. They are convinced, I think erroneously, that the U.S. Intends to overthrow the regime, and they believe what they call their powerful nuclear deterrent is the way to prevent the U.S. from taking action to overthrow the regime. So for them, the program is key to their survival. And a previous guest talked about Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. The North Korean leadership believes that Gaddafi was foolish to give up its nuclear capability. Look what happened to him. Once Saddam gave up his nuclear program, look at what happened to him. And the Pyongyang regime is saying, we're not going to make that mistake. We're going to hold on to our powerful nuclear deterrent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the world hasn't come very far, has it? You just all these weapons, and there were times when we talked about dismantling them, and look where we are right now, talking about even the possibility of a nuclear confrontation. It's incredible, isn't it?
Well, I remember I was serving in the Obama administration when he made his famous speech in 2009 in Prague, where he said he hopes for a world without nuclear weapons. Well, unfortunately, a lot of disturbing things have happened in those 8-9 years. We've seen, the Russian aggression against Ukraine. We've seen the Chinese behaving more aggressively, more assertively in the Western Pacific. We've seen the North Korean programs. So unfortunately, I think we are we're much farther away from a world without nuclear weapons than when President Obama made his famous speech in Prague.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very sad. Do you think that we're seriously contemplating a military strike on North Korea?
I think the Trump administration wants North Korea to believe we could use a military strike against them. I don't think we will. Vice President Pence was in South Korea recently. He's in Japan today. And he clearly tried to give the impression that President Trump would use military force against the North. President Trump ordered a carrier strike group from the Southeast Asian waters up to the Korean Peninsula in a show of force. So I think we're trying to convey the impression that we could use military force. I don't believe we will. I think people like Secretary Mattis, like General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, recognize that there are tremendous risks in using military force against North Korea. The North Koreans have 15 or so thousand artillery pieces within range of the capital city of South Korea, Seoul.
Goodness.
And if we used force against North Korea, we could count on a very harsh retaliation that would put tens of thousands of citizens of Seoul in extreme jeopardy. Mm. And I don't think we're prepared to take that risk, and certainly our South Korean allies are very reluctant to take that risk.
A lot of people are saying the president has turned over all of these decisions to the military, to the generals that you just mentioned. Do you have reason to believe that's true, that he's not making the ultimate decision?
I'm sure he would make the ultimate decision. I think he will rely very heavily on the advice of his military commanders, the commanders who are in South Korea, as well as General Mattis. And so he will depend on that advice. But their advice will be recommendations to him. He will have to make the final call.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this part of the show is Robert Einhorn, Senior Fellow in the Arms Control Nonproliferation Initiative and the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at Brookings. He also served at the U.S. State Department as Special Advisor for Nonproliferation and Arms Control, a position that was created by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake first. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for having me on. My comment is a question to your guest. I mean, we had in the Soviet Union for decades the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, which was the danger of nuclear weapons were offset by two rational players. My question to your guest is that, I mean, we have from people who have escaped North Korea, not many, they have concentration camps there. There's something between fascism, communist authoritarianism. My question, I guess, is are we dealing with what you would call a non-rational player, and is that probably the ultimate danger to ourselves in South Korea? I'd like to hear his response.
Thanks, Jim.
Jim, I think the North Korean leadership, including this young leader, Kim Jong-un, I think they are rational. I think they calculate. I think they are probably more cautious than their bombastic rhetoric would lead us to believe. They may be impulsive, but they're not suicidal. And they understand that provocative actions on their part, especially the use of nuclear weapons, would be met with an overwhelming U.S. Response. There's a difference between dealing with North Korea now and dealing with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. We were with the Soviet Union dealing with a rational, calculating player who had a lot at stake. And kind of rules of the road over a course of decades had been worked out after the Cuban Missile Crisis to ensure that we didn't get ourselves into a situation where we went over the brink. With North Korea, the problem is that they're paranoid about U.S. intentions. They're convinced that in any conflict, we will move quickly to overthrow their regime, to decapitate their regime. And the concern in any conflict on the Korean Peninsula is that they will calculate that they may lose. They may be overthrown. So what they may have to do is use nuclear weapons first in the hope that they will force us and our South Korean allies to back down. And that's the only way they can ensure the survival of the regime. From a narrow perspective, that may be rational if survival is their number one objective.
Mm. How old is Kim Jong-un?
No one knows absolutely for sure, but we believe 32.
And what about South Korea? I want to hear your thoughts on this, considering the fact that they're in a bit of political turmoil and need new elections. Can they be a more forceful player in all of this than they have been, considering their political woes?
Well, they've had a caretaker government for several months now. Now that there's been an impeachment of their president, President Park, there will be an election coming up in a few weeks. It is likely, although not sure, not for certain, it's likely that a so-called progressive, left-of-center government will take over. And a left-of-center government is likely to take a somewhat more accommodating position toward the North. They will be more interested in negotiations with the North. They'll be more interested in dialogue than the conservative regime that they follow. I think it's critical. Any successful policy toward North Korea for the United States must include cooperation with both China and South Korea. We can't hope to have effective policy against North Korea if we don't have the full support of the South Korean government. And one thing is for sure. No South Korean government, whether conservative or left of center, is going to want to take military risks. I think any South Korean government will want to at least pursue the possibility of negotiations. Negotiations backed by strong pressures for sure, but they will want to see if negotiations could get anywhere. Mm.
Is it still on the minds of, if not the leadership, the people who live in both South and North Korea to see a reunification of the country?
That's the official policy, both of South and North. You know, they have in the past discussed it from time to time, but not terribly seriously. These are two very, very antithetical forms of government.
Yes.
And it's hard to imagine reaching an accommodation, but it's still the stated goals of both North and South.
American military presence, one of our callers the last half hour talked about 28,000 American troops being there. Is that figure correct?
It's just about correct, something like 28,500. It's close to 30,000.
I had no idea it was that many. Are all those people necessary, do you think?
Well, I think they are. We used to have a much larger group of military personnel there. They've been reduced for quite a while. They've been at the figure just below 30,000. These are soldiers, Marines, airmen. And they're a very effective force, but by themselves, they're not sufficient. The U.S. has plans in a crisis to reinforce our contingent on the peninsula by flowing forces by air transport, by ships, to go through Guam, through ports in Japan and South Korea. That's one reason that the North Koreans are developing the missile capabilities to strike Guam, to strike ports and airfields in Japan and South Korea, because they want to block our ability to reinforce our soldiers and Marines on the peninsula. But you shouldn't neglect the South Koreans. They have a very effective fighting force.
More phone calls for our guest in a moment. We're talking about North Korea this hour of the show. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jim, thanks for your great call. We'll take more calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Sarah in Zion and our next caller for you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you very much. You know, I have a question, but that scenario that the guest just laid out as being, like, quote, rational, unquote, just I have to comment on that. I mean, if they think that they could stop the U.S. with, like, one or two hydrogen bombs, well, that's just not rational because they would get hit again. And if they developed enough to completely take out the U.S., well, that's just going to cause them enough radiation to do pretty much everybody in. So how is that rational? I mean, plus one of our allies could strike them. And then, like, China. Is China going to... Are they compelled by treaty or inclination to strike back at us if we strike Korea, North Korea?
Well, on your second question, there's some kind of a mutual friendship arrangement between China and North Korea. But at this stage, I think China is so disillusioned with the policies of North Korea that it would not consider itself bound to come to the defense of North Korea if there was a war between the United States and North Korea. This is not 1950 and the replay of the Korean War. I think the Chinese are much less inclined to support their erstwhile ally. In terms of rationality and so forth, first of all, I can't imagine the North Koreans ever having the substantial nuclear capability to obliterate the United States. You know, this is not the Soviet Union. This is not today's Russia. You know, they're not going to be able to develop that capability. Of course, it's bad enough if they have one or two weapons that can strike the United States. In terms of rationality, if they really believe that firing one or two nuclear weapons is the only way they're going to get the United States and the South Koreans to back down from a conventional assault, and the only way they can stave off the termination of the regime, it may be rational in a narrow kind of sense for them to initiate the use of nuclear weapons, even though it could lead to a devastating U.S. response, and it would lead to a devastating U.S. response. But if there's a small chance that they can get the U.S. to back off, that may be rational if they think the U.S. is intent on overthrowing their regime.
Let's play this out. These negotiations, I mean, who knows if there's a chance at all that these are going to happen. Who would you put at the table? What do you imagine North Korea would want? And what would we want? And could we get together on anything where any areas where there might be mutual agreement?
Well, who would be at the table? During the 2000s, from about 2003 to 2009, there were the so-called six-party talks. Mm-hmm. That was North and South Korea, United States, China, Russia, and Japan. There could be such a configuration again. But what would happen is that from time to time, the U.S. and North Korea would sit down bilaterally. And I think in any negotiation, those would be the two main protagonists, the United States and North Korea. Now, what would be the objectives? What would both sides want? I think what the North Koreans would want would be the acceptance by the United States and the rest of the international community that North Korea can have nuclear weapons, that we accept North Korea as a nuclear weapons state. That will not happen. Mm-hmm. The North Koreans also probably want us to remove all sanctions, economic sanctions. I think that will not happen unless North is prepared to give up its nuclear program. They'd also like to see the discontinuation of the U.S.-South Korean treaty alliance. That won't happen either. So they will come with a wish list. They probably know they can't achieve much on that wish list. In terms of U.S. objectives, our principal objective would be the complete and verifiable denuclearization of North Korea. The North Koreans will be very reluctant to do that. They're going to want to hold on to the nuclear deterrent for a long, long time, maybe forever. If that's not achievable, it's perhaps possible to negotiate a kind of cap, a freeze on their nuclear and missile capabilities, which would at least temporarily enable the North to keep what they have, but it would stop them from achieving high confidence in the ability to strike the United States with an intercontinental range missile.
Hmm. Well, that doesn't sound too promising, does it? Karen, thanks for the call. One more call. We're almost out of time. Larry in Rockford. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Nobody is considering the possibility that North Korea already has nuclear weapons here, that they could be smuggled in shipping containers. Hardly any of those containers are inspected. Who knows what's in most of them? Should a war break out, they blow up one and they say, we've got more. Now what?
That's a scary scenario. I think it's a very unlikely one. They have not produced a superabundance of plutonium and highly enriched uranium that you need to build bombs. So it is probably unlikely that they've built a bunch of them and stowed them away, freighters and so forth. Also, we track very carefully shipments by North Korea. And it's very unlikely that the North Koreans have been able to bring cargo or other kinds of ships into U.S. harbors. These things are not terribly easy to smuggle in. They're pretty large. They can be detected by radiation detection equipment. So I think that scenario is very, very unlikely.
Thank you, Robert, very much for being with us. It was an interesting and important hour. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Robert Einhorn, Senior Fellow at the Arms Control Nonproliferation Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Many thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News is coming up. The March on Science, Hour 2.